Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the LFC Day Trippers Fatback 4 podcast special. I'm your host, Keith Plunka, and I'm delighted to be joined by football historian and author, Peter Kenny Jones. And Peter's going to discuss his upcoming book, Little at 100, about the life and times of the great Billy Little. Peter, how are you?
I'm still good, thanks very much. How are you?
I'm great. Just to give you all a heads up, me and Pete have had a great chat there for the last while and the show did not record. So we're going to come back in and do it all again. But yeah, as I said there, Peter, you've got a book coming out now in November, isn't it? And it's just about Billy Little. And any regular listeners to the show know I absolutely love football from a bygone era, football that's not maybe spoken about anymore and not touched upon. And you know, Billy Little is such an important figure in the history of Liverpool Football Club that it's great to get this information now. So if you want to give us a bit of input into what the book is about and what you had to do to get it to where it is.
Yeah, so obviously basically a biography of his life, so start to finish, Billy Little, in celebration of what would have been his 150, which is coming up in January. Obviously, called it a family portrait, because I've just tried to speak to as many people as possible, really, so speaking to family, friends, teammates, supporters, and just tried to make the full picture of his life. You know, I didn't want it to be, you know, just quoting newspaper after newspaper or whatever, just I wanted it to be the full story of his life, but maybe with, you know, unheard of stories, and just try and look at it a different way rather than just going game by game and just try to give a different side, but just tell the full story of his life and why he's so well regarded and so well loved at Liverpool.
And just so the people know, you're gonna in the compiling of the book, you've spoken to his family members of Billy Little and relatives and ex players, and you know, you got a real feel for Billy Little, the man, didn't you? Beyond what, you know, we may know from seeing the odd video or reading the odd article, you really got a feel for Billy and his life.
Yeah, definitely. So the video that was available isn't great. You know, if you look at Cherrington from the time, it's the British Pathé and movie tone, and basically it's just like a 10-second report of the game. You might see that getting ahead to a ball that went in, you wouldn't see anything else other than that of a move. So it's hard to get a full idea of what the games were like, but that's why I tried to speak to as many people as I can. Spoke to, you know, his sister Rena was a massive help, spoke to his twin son, spoke to Tom Ogilvy, his cousin. I've got some, you know, sisters-in-laws and family friends there, but obviously a lot of supporters who were really keen to share the story of him. And there's eight, nine ex-players he played with, one ex-Scotland international. So it's just trying to get I tried to meet as many people as I could, and that was my dad's job helping me write all the interviews out. So that was it. I was paying him in black pudding to write up all my interviews.
That's it, an apprentice. You had your apprentice.
That was it. Just try and tell the full story of his life, as I said, and speak to as many people as I could, really.
Yeah, excellent. So take us back to the start. So, I mean, it's in the title, really, isn't it? Little at 100. So Billy was born in 1922. So January. So we're coming up to that 100th birthday. So he's born. Take it away. Where is he born? And yeah, what's his early life like?
Yeah, so he's in Town Hill, Dunfermline. He's just son of a miner. There was a lot of footballers were at that time. And his mum and dad were just really wanted to make sure they all had a trade behind them. So, you know, obviously Billy's one was being an accountant, and he was really good at school. He sounded like one of those kids you date in school. He was good at everything. He was just good at football, good at rugby, good at athletics, clever, you know, passed with flying colours with everything. So I think, you know, for him it was, you know, it was quite a good childhood, and his mum and dad were just really sure on making sure they were all set up for life. They didn't want them all down the mine. So Billy was the oldest, and which led the way, really. You know, his brother Tom played for Liverpool as well, and he was lucky enough to be a cobbler as well afterwards. So when his football fell through a bit, he got to go on and have another pastime. So I think they were caring parents and really tried to map out the life of the kids. And, you know, it was a lot of lads, and yeah, there's two twin siblings at the end, Rita and George. And so Rita was the one who helped me the most with the book. And yeah, it was just a normal 19, 20s, 30s childhood, really. And luckily for Billy, he was just really good at football, which helped take him out of the small town life.
Yeah, so that's it. I mean, as you say, he's got a talent for football, and he's playing youth football up there, locally up, I suppose, around Dunfermline or in the locality there. And he is brought to the attention of Liverpool scouts by a famous name. Who was it that spots him or recommends him to Liverpool?
Yeah, so he just signed for Liverpool at the time from Man City. It was Matt Busby. So he was on the golf course with one of his ex-City teammates, and basically just got a tip that City were looking at this lad in Dunfermline, who was really good. But they weren't sure they were going to get the deal over the line. Obviously, Liverpool, he was new to Liverpool. He was just trying to impress. Obviously, he came as an experienced player. He tipped off George Kaler, manager, and just said, might be worth going to have a look at him. Sounds quite good. And that's what they did, really. And, you know, his mum and dad were vetting all the clubs that were coming to watch him. I think Partick Thistle and Arsenal put offers in to take him, and so did Man City, but they wanted to make sure he had a family home to live in. He had a job lined up, and he was going to be guaranteed to be playing football. So it was a hard deal to make for a 16-year-old in Dunfermline, but his mum and dad were confident in his ability, and they wanted to make sure he had a life set up if it did go wrong. So, you know, they looked after him, and fortunately for Liverpool, they're the ones who got his signature.
Excellent. So he moves to Liverpool at 16 years old, and it's a big, I suppose, upheaval for someone so young. But where does he end up? How does he get to Liverpool, and what's his early days like at the club?
Yeah, so obviously it was 1938, so it wasn't long before the war began, but obviously they didn't know at the time. He was set up with, you know, a former Liverpool player, Ned Doig, which I think is how you say it. He'd passed away. It was his widow and his son still lived in the clubhouse, so he basically asked if they wouldn't mind, you know, Billy coming and living with them, and they just look after him. Obviously, that was something, again, that the family encouraged, because they wanted him to have, like, a family environment around him. So he was just a young lad in Liverpool. He was very religious, went to church, you know, he never drank, never swore, so he wasn't like he was going out of town with his top off or anything. He was just doing his stuff. He was working and playing his football and impressing in the reserves and in the A team, and, you know, making small headlines, just saying that, you know, this young lad looks like he could have some talent. And unfortunately for him, and obviously the whole world, the war started and really interrupted his career, but it looked like he was just on the cusp of getting into the team before it all kicked off.
Yeah, so like that, 1938, he's a 16-year-old lad. He's about to make it big at Liverpool, and the war breaks out. Nobody knows, you know, what's lying ahead there. But his football continues during this period, doesn't it? He's, while it's not... it's not recognized, unfortunately, but Billy plows ahead and has a successful wartime career, doesn't he?
Yeah, definitely. You know, he was definitely part of the team, and it was, you know, the first game after the war broke out, when, you know, the game stopped being official. Yeah. He was straight in the Liverpool team, and it was only a friendly against Preston. But then the first wartime game he played, and, you know, that first season, he was part of the squad. He was definitely making appearances. He scored 9 and 16 in his first wartime season. You know, that's as a 16-year-old, so. He was a big part of the squad, and I said maybe it did help him a bit. You know, maybe he wasn't fully ready to play first team football, but it gave him that access to it. It got, let him play with the best players that, you know, the club had to offer, and he really got to be bedded into it. The West style of play, and to go and watch, you know, go and play in front of thousands of people at Anfield, and get, you know, the atmosphere and the players he was playing with. So he was definitely part of the squad, and because he was so young, it took him a few years before he was actually sent off to the war. So it probably did help him a little bit, you know, in terms of the war, giving him access to first team football.
Yeah, indeed. And wartime football, you know, there was a lot of moving around, and, you know, games here, there and everywhere, wasn't there? Like, so it would have been a pretty colourful time to be playing. He wouldn't have been just playing with Liverpool at the time, was he?
No, definitely, yes. We travelled around England, most notably played for Chelsea quite a few times. Went up to Scotland, played for Dunfermline, which obviously was, you know, his childhood team, and it was a big one for the family, because it was the first time they could really watch him play, like, a high level of football. And, you know, all the press and all his family were proud to have him there. And then again, he went to Northern Ireland. He had to turn down Elijah Scott because he wanted him to play. He was playing for someone else at the time. And then he went to Canada and played where he wasn't supposed to play. So he had to play under a pseudonym of Bill Tanner. And basically he said, they were like, oh, do you play football? He said, not really. And went on and scored 4 in about 10 minutes. So I think they realised he was quite a good player. So I think even his wife told the story of when he was in training in Warrington, you know, he basically broke out of the barracks one night so he could go and play football for Liverpool the next day, because he was just missing football so much as a young lad, and he just wanted to keep playing wherever he was. So it was, you say, it wasn't just for Liverpool, but he was definitely had an itch that needed scratching with football, and fortunately he could keep it up while he was fighting in the war.
Yeah, because he was in the RAF, wasn't he, during the war, and he did actually, you know, it wasn't all just playing football and waiting on the war to kick off again.
Yeah, so he was a navigator in the RAF, so obviously he wouldn't fly the planes, but would be alongside them. And, you know, people he met then were, you know, one of the people he met during the war was his best man, and, you know, it was a pretty important time in his formative years as a footballer and as a man, really. And yeah, he was definitely involved in the war efforts, and, you know, telling the story that, you know, his family made a lot of jokes that he was really bad at navigation, and found it ironic that he was given the task of navigating RAF pilots around to go and bomb Germany. But that's what his job was during the war.
Well, he knew how to hit the target, I suppose. They were on to something. I like that.
Yeah, said that last time.
I didn't know, thinking about it. That's why we started again. But look, the war is going on, a tumultuous time for everybody, and nobody knows what's happening. But Billy is out there, he's playing football, he breaks his leg in one of these games, and, you know, we were talking earlier, a leg break now, you've all the modern medicine and you've all the tools to get back to 100%. But back then, a leg break, well, players probably play through a lot of injuries, a leg break was a significant, possibly a significant setback in his career before he even got going.
Yeah, definitely. You know, so the Djibril Cisse's career, although it didn't end, definitely took a massive hit by the fact he had the two leg breaks. You know, and talk about however many years earlier, you could easily end your career with a leg break. So for him to come through that, obviously, it would have been a big scare at the time. And I'm sure he would have been maybe had a bit of peace in his mind, the fact that he had his accountancy to fall back on. But, you know, he was so football mad, he would have been devastated. So to have that, you know, it was nearly taken away from him, but definitely would have helped spare him on to know, you know, when hopefully the world was back to normal, he could go make sure he made something in football and, you know, didn't waste his talents or lose it.
Excellent. Yeah, so the war happens, the war comes and goes, and eventually games are recognised again and records are being recognised. So Billy comes into the team in 45, is it, or 46? 46 in the FA Cup, 45-46 season FA Cup game. Yeah. Comes in, but you were saying something interesting. There was still wartime games sort of going on around then as well. And it was...
Yeah, because obviously... Sorry, go on. Just so obviously because the war ended in the September, so obviously... The traditional season starts in the August, and they never said, you know, well, we'll just rush the season through and change the fixtures. They basically just said, right, well, you can have the rest of the year as still wartime while we try and get everything sorted, but the FA Cup will count. So, it was, you know, they were playing FA Cup games that apparently mattered more than the two wartime friendlies that were either side of it. But, you know, they weren't just friendlies. They were in leagues, and they had the cup at the end of every season. It wasn't just for nothing. That was probably the most meaningless season that they had, but the FA Cup was everything that mattered. So it wasn't until 46-47 that the first division came back.
Indeed. So he comes into the team and he's a left winger. And, you know, football now and football then, it's a totally different kettle of fish. So Billy's playing as a winger back then, but the formation, it would have been the wide of a front five nearly, wouldn't it? And then ahead of maybe a back five. So it was the formations that people played were very different. But Billy was a winger predominantly in his early years before moving maybe more centrally. And we're going to talk about his goal scoring prowess and how, you know, it could and should have been better than it is now. So for a wide player at the time, like Billy's... we can talk about his numbers at the end. So I have it wrote down that he made 534 appearances and got 228 goals, which places him, I don't know, sixth or fifth or something in the all-time goal scoring charts. But he's actually, it's a disservice to him, isn't it? Because the wartime.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle, a run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Yeah, I wanted to tell you, because I tried to add it on the book. Obviously, he's sixth at the moment, so he would have been fourth top goal scorer, and he would have been his second top appearance, so it's the other way around, but I put it in there. Yeah. But basically, you know, just him and all of his peers, you know, that a lot of their career was robbed, and for him to be as high up as he is and be one of the players, you know, in that list. Obviously, you know, the people he's up amongst, you know, it's not all of them had wartime affecting their career. Obviously, he was probably the one with the most of his career taken off him. So again, it just shows the impact he had on the club at the time. And I think even when you look through his first season, he played 40 games, so he scored 8 goals. It wasn't... He really grew into being the goal scorer that he went on to be. I think the fact that he developed his game changed so much, and it was just a totally different style of play, as you say, the five up front. And I've tried to explain, I think, you know, for me, I can try and call myself the football historian. I didn't fully understand the formation, so I tried to like lay it out visually so you can see like what it actually means. So they're playing outside left and number 11, as you say, it was like basically playing Andy Robertson's position, but without having to track back. That was basically what he was. So to do that and score so many goals, you know, how many did Trent and Robbo score? He don't score many. So for him to be able to have that involvement, and we cut inside, he could shoot even fourth, he was scoring with his head. And also later on in his life, as you say, he moved more centrally because, you know, he had such a good eye for goals. So I think, you know, his ability out wide is ridiculous. You know, you say what Salah's like now, he's a winger up amongst all them, but you know, that's what Billy was, and you know, he just deserves a lot of respect for how many goals he scored.
Indeed. So I mean, back then in the 1950s and sort of post-war in the English game, you had sort of the superstars of the time, are your Stanley Matthews and Tom Finneys and all these guys, and they were the trickier type of winger. But you know, the Stanley Matthews, it beat three men and then get his cross away, whereas Billy was all pace, power and directness, wasn't he? And that was just down to his hard work and all. He was just a different type of player, wasn't he? He was different to the other great players of the time.
Yeah, well, definitely all played in similar positions, but did it their own way. And obviously, there's no right or wrong way. And obviously, Stanley Matthews, unbelievable player. And I think, obviously, for Billy to be up alongside him just shows how important he was. I think, you know, he is overlooked a bit because maybe because he played for Liverpool, didn't he? You look at Tom Finney and Stanley Matthews and the clubs they were at, you know, there can't be anyone higher than him because Billy's played at a club where we've had Kenny Dalglish and Steven Gerrard. He can be overlooked a little bit, but you know he was up there with the world's best, and for him to be mentioned alongside those, and it was only him and Stanley Matthews who played for Great Britain more than once. For him to be amongst them just shows how good he was and his goal scoring records and everything. So I think the style of play of him was just he didn't know what he could do. He was fast. He could beat you, he'd take it round you, he could have a shot from where he wanted, and he'd beat you in the air. So he didn't know what to do against him. So I think obviously that's why he was so effective out wide.
Indeed. And another thing I read about him, like he'd never been booked or sent off in his career, but I don't think that was a big thing back then in any way. But people that played against him would always have said, you know, he was very hard, but very fair. And that, you know, in an era when players were probably, you know, a lot more rough play than what happens now. You know, he was very well regarded by his peers. And when you think about it, like he breaks into the team, as we said, his debut one season, and he really pushes in the following year and he win the league. Liverpool win the league, but it's the only silverware that he wins at Liverpool. And it's at the beginning of his career. Do you think maybe the lack of success of the team maybe hinders Billy's reputation outside of Liverpool?
Well, yeah, definitely. You know, you say when someone sticks to a team through thick and thin, and there literally was no thinner point in Liverpool's history than when Billy was there, and they were coming 11th in the second division. But the team he came into was, you know, it was a good blend because obviously it was hard to do transfers while the war's going on. So when he came back, they had a lot of experienced players who had been there for a long time. They had a lot of players who were at the peak of their career when the war started. They were now aging, and then young players like Billy were coming into their early 20s, and for them they wanted to hit the ground running, and they had the ability to do so. So it was a good blend of players at the start, which I think maybe they just didn't replace the experience as the years passed on, which is why maybe Liverpool weren't as good as they were. But obviously the 46-47 season, it's unbelievable. You know, there's a chapter on it in the book, but the way that season ends was just, it's like it makes the Aguero moment look like nothing. You know, the season was a joke. Like the last few games, it was everywhere, and they found out they won it while Liverpool were playing Everton in the Lancashire Cup final. So there was a ground full of people, and because there was no TV or anything to watch it, that was the best place to listen to it. And they were changing the scoreboard, and then when they found out that Sheffield United had got the result that they needed for them, there was hats getting thrown and everything. So it's a different style of football, but it's still, the drama was there, and that team was a successful one. And you know, they had Phil Taylor, who was a great captain, and Jack Barmer, who was really pivotal in the end of that season. And Albert Stubbins, who was the record signing, which, you know, another interesting fact was that was the record signing was broke in his first season, 46-47. And that transfer fee wasn't broken until his last ever season, 61. So it shows the board just basically were right behind him at the start. And then they just, as Shankly said, they were like gamblers on a losing streak. They just were too scared to make any changes. So I think the way that the club was getting run, it was just getting worse and worse. And unfortunately for Billy, you know, all his success, and only one trophy, and then the FA Cup final in 1950, all his success was really at the start of his career.
Yeah, indeed. And he goes through the 1950s, and you know, Liverpool get relegated in, I keep getting this, 55, is it, they go down to the second division. And Billy is then, you know, he's not, it's not that it's unfair to say he's a one man band at that stage, but the over reliance on Billy was huge. And we were speaking earlier, comparing it to another Liverpool great, Steven Gerrard, maybe during periods when expectation was just heaped on him. And if, you know, Billy didn't do it the way Stevie didn't do it, Steven Gerrard won an awful lot of, you know, the comparison. I'm just talking about the expectation, you know, grabbing it by the scruff, playing in teams that probably weren't up to his level. And Billy just kept going and kept going. But they went down, there was managerial changes happening and, you know, a lot of change in to and from. But Billy was the constant throughout the 1950s, wasn't he? He was consistent, and he was hitting goals, and he was always the shining light.
Yeah, definitely. I think it is a good comparison with Gerrard. Obviously, it's easy to say because it's more recent, but, you know, Billy had offers to go and take the mega bucks wherever he wanted to go. Colombia separated themselves from FIFA and just said, you know, they were happy for him to pay him a blank check, basically, but he wanted to stay where he was. Aston Villa tried
the weekly wage, wasn't it? Sorry for cutting across you there, Pete. The weekly wage was like 12 quid or something at the time.
Yeah,
Colombia
went up to 20 at the end. Yeah, but they were just paying whatever, yeah.
They took like Alfredo Di Stefano and all went to play there at Millonarios, I think, in Colombia, and they just took the cream of the crop and it was outside of FIFA and caused all sorts. But Billy resisted the urge to go over there.
Yeah, well, I think it was probably the biggest discussion he had, and what he probably said, should they go? No, because everyone else he wouldn't even ask, should they go? He just was turning every single way, but I think it was the fact that, you know, Liverpool had been so good to him, and the fact, you know, they gave him that job as he was as a 16-year-old, to give him the house. One of the first clubhouses that they bought was because they realised, you know, basically Liverpool wasn't as fashionable or as attractive as London was for a lot of players around the country. So they started trying to buy clubhouses, and rather than just trying to entice people in, they made sure they gave Billy one of the first ones. So I think he appreciated what the club had done to him. And then you say the leg break at the start. He'd fought a war. He'd not long met his wife, who was from Liverpool. I think it all adds together. And, you know, it wasn't just a pursuit of silverware for him. You know, he realised that the club had been good to him. And what a lot of players aren't like today, he realised that he probably should be nice back to them. So, obviously, it helps that the wage meant he couldn't earn any more anywhere else. But he still had offers to go and play top-level football, and he wanted to stay at Liverpool. He wanted to be the one to drag them out of the second division.
Yeah. And another thing you touched on earlier was that his father passed away, I think, early in his Liverpool career. Was it 1951 or something? His father passed away, and he brought his family down. And it was like he wanted to lay roots in Liverpool. You know, I suppose the city meant a lot to him, even at that sort of early age. But he pushes through, and, you know, he's in a team. And for the book, would you have spoke to many of his teammates at the time? Like, would you have had some contact with some of the people that he played with?
Yeah, so obviously, I know it's unfortunate that a lot of the people I tried to speak to have even passed away since I've written it, Tommy Leishman and Roger Hunter recently. So obviously it was sad. I think I looked at it, I haven't got the exact number, but I think there was like 95 players or 120 players, something like that. But it was surprisingly small amount for how many years he played with. But that's how many players he played with for Liverpool, and only 9 of them were alive at the time. So, you know, it really is a period that's on the brink of extinction. It felt like an honour, really, just to speak to some of the people, because I think one of them was Alex South, who I spoke to, and he only played 4 games for Liverpool. But his stories he had was unbelievable. And, you know, you look at the stats of these people and you disregard them, but you realise the stories they've got, because they spent years playing with Billy. And I was lucky enough to speak to the list here: Gordon Wallace, Gordon Milne, Johnny Morrissey, Jimmy Melia, Keith Beckinshaw, George Scott and Alan Banks. And they all had a different insight into what he was like and what the team was like. A lot of them were, obviously, because of how long it's been since he played, a lot of them were younger players coming in towards the end of his career. But again, they just commented on the respect he had and how much, you know, Bill Shankly really looked to him at the end. And, you know, another great one who I spoke to was Ian Callaghan, who's done a four-way for me. And he was the man who basically took his shirt, you know, grew up watching him on the cop, to then go wear number 11 and try and do what Billy did. And obviously, he ended up breaking his appearance record. So it was a good, you know, passing of the flame. And then got to speak to Alan Hansen, who showed what it was like when he was a fan, you know, while Billy was watching every week, and he tried to get the players' advice. And then Jamie Carragher, who also helped and basically showed how his legacy lived on through Ronnie Moran and the ways, you know, they were trying to, you know, the fact that Billy was up there with, you know, Dalglish, Souness, all the biggest names, and, you know, Rush, he'd always be up there amongst them because Ronnie Moran had played with him as well. So it shows how highly thought of he was even long after he passed away.
Yeah, because they'd done that 100 players who shook the cup, and he came sixth in that. And, you know, when you think of the players that have come through Liverpool, you know, for a poll to be done in the modern age to have Billy still up there in the top 10, it's a wonderful achievement and a recognition of a hero, of a bygone era. But we touched on the fact there that Liverpool got relegated in 55, and they, you know, the silverware wasn't happening for Billy, unfortunately, at the time. But there was a sliding doors moment in the 55-56 season where, you know, possibly one of his most famous moments in a red shirt happened. Do you want to take that away? It's a fifth round FA Cup replay against Man City.
Yes, well, I think obviously we're speaking to people, a lot of them, that I'd always just say, like, what's the main thing that comes to your mind when you think of Billy? And one of them was, you know, the fact that he was called Liverpool, the fact that he was, him and only Stanley Matthews had played for Great Britain twice, and then this game and the non-goal. Obviously, City had just gone 2-1 up, literally seconds left on the clock, and basically they took the kick off. Billy just on a one-man mission, took it past a couple of players, 30, 40 yards out, just hit an absolute rocket, flew in the back of the net, the referee's whistle go, and Anfield's a pandemonium, and all the players are running off. Looks like, you know, it's about to be extra time. And then they had to put over the Tannoy, the referee had blown up for full time before it hit the back of the net, and it basically just blew up into, like, it was just a joke, really. All the fans were kicking off, and then the next day the Echo ran a picture with the referee's hands up after the ball had hit the back of the net, and they were saying, oh, he'd blown up afterwards, it shouldn't have counted. And I was saying, you can just imagine what social media and what it would be like now with, you know, how much of a joke it was. You know, how much people still know about, like, Luis Garcia's goal, and it would have been the same type of thing. You'd have watched that back and say, you know, what a joke. But yeah, it really was a pivotal moment because, you know, that was what Billy was all about. He was taking his team by the scruff of the neck, and he was on his way to taking them to the next round, or at least taking them to extra time. And I should say, what happened with Bertrand later that year shows how important Billy was and how much both their lives would have been different if the referee had waited about half a second more before he blew his whistle.
Which is quite interesting. If people don't know, Man City go on to win the FA Cup that year, and Bert Trautmann, who was he a POW? He was a Nazi soldier, a German soldier in the war, and he was a POW, and he's playing in goal. He wins the Football Writers' Player of the Year that year, just before the FA Cup final, and has a collision against Birmingham and breaks certainly three or four vertebrae in his neck. I don't know if that's classed as a full neck break, but he breaks his neck in the game, plays on, gets man of the match. And it so nearly wouldn't have happened. You know, Bert Trautmann is famous for that. Now, I know he plays on afterwards, and I'm sure he wouldn't have liked the neck break, but it could have been so different for Billy if they go through. That could have been an FA Cup win, which the FA Cup then is a different kettle of fish than what it is now. It's much more beloved and much more highly regarded back then than it is now. And Liverpool hadn't won it even at that stage. So yeah, he was maybe robbed of a big moment.
Yeah, I would definitely say that how important the cup was at the time. And obviously, I think they reached the final in 1914. And then obviously Billy was part of the 1950 FA Cup final. And obviously was a massive blow because they'd beaten Arsenal home and away that season. And obviously, I think when they reached the final, they were top of the league by a few points. And obviously going to the FA Cup final, the season just completely fell apart. And they finished outside at the top four and they lost the final. It just all went wrong. And they would have been the first post-war team to win the double had they done that. So it really was a massive one. And then obviously to have that moment again, and they knew they had FA Cup prowess, and they had some massive games against Everton, and they were always the big, the one that got the crowds going. So they knew how important the FA Cup was. And as you say, just to have that moment robbed from him and from the fans, it was really controversial at the time.
Yeah, a tough one to take. And I think he took over the captaincy then as well, did he? He became the Liverpool captain in his latter years as well. From Laurie Hughes, so I could be wrong.
Yeah, I think it was a bit of a tough one because it changed quite a lot in that period. It was never like a really official time that he had it. And he, you're right there.
Yeah, so they're whacking the knee off the table.
Sorry, don't worry. He had the captain's armband, but it wasn't for too long. But I think, you know, he led by example. He wasn't someone who would ever shout and ball at someone. So I think maybe when your team's in the second division and struggling a bit, I think maybe you needed someone who was going to put a rocket up someone. So I think that's maybe why he didn't hold on it for so long. But the respect he had amongst the players, which was why he was awarded, you know, the armband, they'll obviously wear it, but the armband at that time.
And it was a period, as we touched on earlier on the Ghost show, was, you know, the second division back then. So he spends the second half of the 1950s up till the end of his Liverpool career playing in the second division. It's unfair. It's a shame maybe that he wasn't playing first division football, and maybe it does sort of shadow his legacy a bit, you know, in the wider game. But the second division, it was a tough league to play in, as the Championship is now. But, you know, there was, even though he was doing his business in the second division, it was still being noticed and would still be, you know, it's not that it's devalued. He was still there doing scoring goals and making all these appearances, and it just never really happened for him. He was part of an era then before, I think, Bill Shankly comes in 1959, correct me if I'm wrong. Comes in, and at that stage, Billy is, he must be near 40 at that stage, is he? Or it's certainly in his late
30s. Yeah, he was 13 when he retired, and that was in 61. So yeah, he'd have been, late 30s. And
a lot of miles in his legs, you know, he's playing a long time and a lot of hard yards in those legs of his, those tree trunk legs. But he's moved more centrally, really, isn't he? At the, when the pace starts to decline, he's more, the brain is more what he's playing off. And he's, Bill Shankly highly regarded Billy, but he was at the end of his career. But it's a new dawn coming in at Liverpool, and you touched on the fact that it's Ian Callaghan that replaces him in the team, and is, you know, I was reading that one of his last games he's substitute for Roger Hunt, you know, and it's all these illustrious names, Jimmy Mealy, as you touched on, you know, these players that are bringing us into the 1960s, and it was just the end of one era before the dawn of a successful era. And it's something that we don't, you know, there's an era of football now that's on the verge of being forgotten, isn't there?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, a lot of people think, you know, as you said before, football began in 92, and a lot of Liverpool fans think it began in 1959 when Shankly came, but it wasn't. You know, there was a lot of football before it. And I think, you know, Phil Taylor was the man who ultimately took Billy out of the team, and it was in 58, and it was the first time in 20 years that Billy had ever been dropped. He'd obviously been injured or whatever, but he'd literally not missed a game from 1913, from the war starting, to 1958. So they put that out, and the fans were gutted, because, you know, he was still doing it. He wasn't a bad player, and Phil Taylor tried to put him back out wide and was playing him in the reserves as a winger, but the fans wanted him back as a number nine, because they knew, I think it was Alan Arnell was playing at the time. They were just saying he wasn't as good as what Billy was, but Phil Taylor was trying to make him back into a winger, which is, you know, whether it was the right decision for the 36-year-old, but he was just still so loved by the fans. And I think when Shankly came in, I think he played about one or two games to start the season under Phil Taylor, and then when Shankly came in, I think he played 11 of the last 14 or something mad like that. So he was, Shankly realised that he, although he had lost a lot of his pace, and, you know, maybe he definitely wasn't the player he was, I think for Shankly it was important to have someone that, you know, knew how Shankly wanted to play, because he played with him at Scotland, and he both played together wartime football at Liverpool. So I think it was important for him to have that leader in terms of example and the football he wanted to play. And basically, Billy was replaced by Ian St. John, who was coming a couple of years later, and Roger Hunt. So, as you say, it was a massive changeover at that time, and Billy was just really a really, really unlucky player, because if he was born 10 years later, he'd have been part of, you know, that first FA Cup win, and if he was born 20 years later, he'd have been dominating Europe. So he was born 100 years later, he'd be worth millions of pounds. So he's just really unlucky on the time he was born, but he definitely made the most of it with, you know, his ability, and the amount the crowd loved him.
Indeed. And again, you know, he had a international career with Scotland. We have a 29 Scotland caps, 8 goals. And that doesn't seem like very much when you think of today's standards, where players are regularly hitting 100 caps and this. But back then, it was a different time, wasn't it?
Yeah, so they'd only play about 3-4 a season, really. You know, they wouldn't be travelling around the world. And they might have in the summer a little tour where they'd go and play another 2 or 3 games. But it was all just the home nations, really, throughout the season, which obviously meant that particularly the Scotland-England games were huge at the time. Yeah. And obviously when he went to Hampden, it was a massive atmosphere. And he did have little tours around Europe, which, you know, there was a few good stories from them, because I managed to speak to Doug Cowie, who was one of his teammates, and he was a big help to saying what it was like. But you know, he had a good amount of caps for the Scotland player at that time, and he was robbed because the Scottish FA were just the shambles, really. They were ran by the people who, the directors of Celtic and Rangers and a couple of other clubs. So they just wanted to pick their own players, and then they wouldn't let the manager pick the team. They just wanted to pick like 4 players each. Yeah. They only took 13 players out of a possible 22 to the World Cup. They turned down a World Cup opportunity because they didn't think that the team should qualify, because they lost to England in the qualifiers. So it just made no sense that what they were doing, really. And Billy was definitely good enough to be part of that team. So I think he was robbed of a lot more caps, robbed of not being able to say play in the World Cup, but for the impact he had for a Scottish player playing in the second division of English football, to be able to get that many appearances, and Great Britain that we touched on before, I think just shows how good he was internationally, not just at club level.
Indeed. And as we said, then is the career peters out. He finishes up in 61, but he's still a face around Anfield, and he's in the players' lounge for games, and he's still a big influence, and he's a hero to a lot of the next generation of players, isn't he? Like, he's the one that they're all looking up to. He was the Kenny Dalglish and the Steven Gerrard of his day, and he was such a big figure. Well, the thing that always comes across about him was he was a humble man, and he lived his life. He played the game the way he lived his life. Like, he wasn't fussy, he wasn't flashy, he was just a strong man who played the game he loved and carried that after his life as well.
Yeah, definitely. He was obviously a big part of the club, and a big part of his life was Liverpool. Obviously, he spent so many years there, moving in 1938, and you come into 1961, obviously it was inevitably be retiring, but he never thought about going back to Scotland. So he wanted to stay in the city. He worked for Liverpool University, and the fans still loved him. It used to be part of the pre-match ritual. They all knew where his seat was in the main stand. He used to come out and they'd all cheer his name and he'd give him a little wave. So like he was still massive in the club, and as you say, a lot of Scottish players coming through. He would never be someone who'd impose himself on them, but he was always happy to listen to them and offer advice if they wanted it. You know, Alan Hansen, when I spoke to him, he couldn't have spoke any more highly of him, really, just saying how he was just trying his best to make sure they were settling in. Obviously, there wasn't many foreign players in those days, so the Scottish players were the foreigners at the time. Yeah. They were the Mo Salahs coming from halfway across the world. So for him to be able to offer advice and speak to them, obviously, would have helped them. And, you know, like with what happened with Andy Robbo, he was so happy to be able to meet Kenny at the time. For all those Scottish players, they'd have grown up watching Billy Liddle. So, for them, it was, even if it was their dad's hero, whatever, it was to be able to meet him and speak to him. And yeah, he loved the club. And unfortunately, like what happened with Bill Shankly, he wanted to be on the board, but they didn't select him. He wanted to be part of the club, and they just didn't really respect him or honour him properly. Yeah. And he deserved a lot more at the time, but that was just the way football was. You needed a lot of money behind you to be. You didn't really have your honorary directors and stuff like that they have today. You needed to have the money to help with the transfers and stuff. So that might be why.
A different role. It's not an ambassadorial job like it is now for so many players. But Billy goes on, and like you said, he passed away. 2001, was it that he passed away?
Yeah.
Do you want to touch on that?
So obviously he had to battle with Alzheimer's, and it was something that I really tried to touch on the book quite a lot, because obviously with what's going on and Roger Hunt has been, you know, similar, and we had a lot of people, you know, Terry McDermott and Nobby Styles, and you can list them all day. It's hard with how many, how many people. And I just think there's no accountability, really. I know, obviously, Alan Shearer has done his documentary on BBC, and I think it just seems clear to everyone that there's a link, but there doesn't seem to have been, like, an official apology or anything. You know, basically, the people in charge of football at the time just weren't taking notice of the fact that there was, especially in winter or when it was raining, there was a couple of players a game going down with head injuries, getting bandaged up, and they'd be wobbling about and the crowd would be laughing. But you know, there was didn't seem to be any consideration to the welfare. So it's, I tried to pick up on it as much as I could, and you don't know, like it must be a link between football, but you don't know which one it was and what game it was. But if you look at all the examples of every time he's getting a head injury, and not just heading the ball because he was so brave going in with big challenges with keepers and defenders, that must be a cause of what it was. And it was, you know, it was in the late 80s he was feeling the effect of it, and he had the illness for such a long time, and basically he just took a step back from public life. His wife didn't really want people to know. So it was just, he kind of got forgotten in that period as well, because, you know, people weren't seeing him. But I think it was really good that in 94, and on the last stand of the Cup, he got to come out to Anfield. I don't think anyone would have known then he wasn't well, but yeah. You know, you can watch the video on that. It's great that, because obviously there was no chance, proper chance in those days. It's great that he could go out full house at Anfield and they could sing his name. And I think that meant a lot to the family that he could do that as well. So I think, obviously, it was a really sad way his life ended, and you know, he died in 2001. But a big part of him had died about 20 years before, really. Yeah. So it was sad, but it's just indicative of what football was like at that time. And unfortunately, now we're seeing all these players passing away with the same illnesses. So it's just sad.
It's too common at the moment, isn't it? As you see, it touched on all those great players, and the same thing, you know. And it's going to get worse, unfortunately, before it does get better. But it's you know, I'm looking forward to reading the book. I can't wait to actually read the book, because it's an era that I love in football. You know, anything that was in black and white, I'm all over. Big fan of it. So I look forward to reading it. So when is the book out?
Yeah, so 8th of November, the day after my birthday. So it's easy to remember. It's out the first one. It's in all the main places you'd expect to see a book. Amazon, WH Smith, Waterstones, all good book stockers, so whatever you say. And I've got it on my own website as well, which would be best for me if people want to get it from there. You can obviously buy the book, I can sign it, and I've done like a few like pre-order bundles, so you can get a couple of programs with it. I think I've got one here actually, so I can get a little like programs, have reproduced them, so like the clubs have let me do it. I've got like I think 5 or 6 from his career, like the 1950 FA Cup final, his testimonial, some from 46-47. So let's try to get that. And then his little brother's autograph book, got that from the 46-47 season when he played for Great Britain, Scotland and for Liverpool. So it's all like the best players at that time. So yeah, it's out on all those main places. And if you can get it from my website, that'll be best for me. But if you just buy it, I'm more than happy.
Brilliant. And we will lash the details up of the website in the show description when it does go out. And people can do that, like support as much as you can, but let's support Peter the best way we can. But Peter, look, it's been a pleasure having you on with us tonight. I've really enjoyed it. Like I said, it's a subject that I really love talking about is football from a bygone era. And this has been one that I've been looking forward to. It's took us a while to get together and do it. But I just want to thank you for your time coming on. It's longer than we probably expected. But thanks for giving us that time to talk. I've really enjoyed it.
Oh, no, thank you very much for having me. Obviously, I just think, as you said, it's a period of football that looks like it might be going extinct. And I think he's one of the best players Liverpool have ever had. So hopefully I can just introduce him to a few new people and then maybe reignite the little flame with the ones who do love him. And hopefully just his story lives on a bit longer, because he deserves that.
Exactly. You know, it's given that bit of posterity to a legend that people are sadly, you know, forgetting about the legends of those eras. So look, anybody watching, get on, get the book, have a read, enjoy it, the story of, as Pete said, one of the greatest ever players to do it for the Reds. But look, it'll be great to get it. Good Christmas present as well for anybody. You know, it's a nice time to be hitting that. But before we finish up, if you like the show, hit the like button, hit the subscribe button. We'll have all the details of where you can get Peter's book. And yeah, you can see on the screen there is that your Twitter handle, @PeterKennyJones. Get on and follow Peter and you'll be able to find out any updates or stuff like that. And look, Pete, it was great having you on. I'd love to get you on again in the future and have another chat. If you are interested in that, that would be excellent. We could definitely do something along those lines. But for tonight, I'm going to say good night and thank you very much for coming on.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you. Good night.
No worries. Listen, take care. This has been the Fatback Four. I've been your host, Keith, and this has been our Little at 100 special. Sports Social Podcast Network.